What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you're tuned in to Kinda Neat. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, as always. First things first, follow me on Twitter, at It's Intuition. Follow my man, Ben Shim, behind the boards, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database, space with two S's, and you can follow us as a unit, at That's Kinda Neat, where I barely tweet, and I'm sorry about that, but sometimes I go on rants when I see shit that pisses me off. Facebook.com/It's Intuition, Facebook.com/KindaNeat, YouTube.com/That's Kinda Neat, where you can see all of our videos, and I know that we haven't posted one in well over a month, and I apologize for that. We are working on it. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Download the podcast app onto your cellular device. Search for Kinda Neat and subscribe, and while you're at it, search for our guests today, Jensen Karp's podcast, Get Up On This, one of my favorite podcasts, and it is a real joy to listen to that one. And I think that if you enjoy this podcast and being early on things that are happening in the music scene, then you will definitely appreciate his show because there are many similar themes. I know we've been gone for a long time. Our last episode was about a month ago, so that is terrible. I fucking feel miserable about that. And even before that, our last video, it has been a month and a half now, and that shit is stressing me the fuck out. Basically, what happened, the studio got booked out for a full 3 weeks, so nobody could really get in to do anything other than the people that were using it. So that was part of it. And then before that, my photo schedule got really busy and I was out doing a bunch of stuff with my buddy Dom. So we got way behind, and that shit drives me nuts. Like right now, I feel so stressed about the podcast because in this era of the 24-second news cycle where things are so fast and you're clicking a link every 2 seconds with some stupid fucking list of 29 reasons that geckos look like a hobbits or something. Like, I don't fucking know. All this stupid shit that you read online, when you don't release any content for a month and a half, all of a sudden people think that you've died or that your channel is done or that you don't care anymore. But I do care. I just want everybody to know, like, we are admittedly kind of going through growing pains right now. The problem that I've been having is, like, the show has gotten big enough to where there are some people that hit me up about it that I feel like would kind of hurt the brand. Like, if I had so-and-so on the show, I feel like it would be a bad look for what our show has been doing. And I always want to keep trying to move forward and move up. Like, that's just a goal that I have. But then at the same time, while I'm trying to move up and move forward and get bigger acts or get acts that I really believe in, or even try to like go farther out into different genres, it's hard to convince bigger acts with bigger metrics that like, yo, this will be a good look for you. I do have complete and utter faith in our interviews, and I have complete and utter faith in our videos. I think they're amazing. Ben makes them sound great every time. Like, doing the videos is never a bad look. If anything, I think some of the videos that we do become people's calling cards. But the point is like, it's like an analogy that I heard for snowboarding back in the day when I used to be heavy into snowboarding. It's like your first few seasons, you get really good and the learning curve is really fucking great. And all of a sudden you're like cruising and you're never crashing and you're doing shit and you look cool doing it. And then all of a sudden you want to start learning to like invert and do flips and do McTwists and all this shit. And all of a sudden for like your third or fourth season, you're just bailing all the fucking time. You're eating tons of shit. You're falling in the snow. You're constantly soaked because snow has gotten down your pants because you're trying new shit and you're trying to get better and you're failing. And that's kind of like where I feel like we're at right now. When I'm reaching out to guests, I'm having trouble kind of convincing people to get on. But I know that very soon things are going to get back into the swing. And so I just want to apologize to our listenership for seeming to be lazy. That is not the case. It's just that I'm trying new things and trying to reach out to artists that I think you guys will really love. With that being said, other shit has been going on in my life too. Man, it's just been heavy, dude. Like, LA is just, I feel like I've been going nuts here. Like, the city is just kind of starting to get to me. I've been living here for about 8 years now. You know, I feel like most people, you kind of decide in your first year or so if it's for you. Like, a lot of people don't make it through their first year here, but I was definitely like, oh yeah, no, this is the place for me. And I've always felt like that. But as I get older and I'm working so many different jobs and so many different outlets, the city's getting tough, dude. It's a hard place to live because you can't really keep normal friendships the way that you can in other cities. It's not like I can call up a friend on a random like Thursday night and be like, hey, what's up, man? Like, I'm going to go eat. Do you want to go eat? Because it's like, oh, well, fuck, dude, you live on the west side and like, oh, it's trafficy right now. And it's like to make a fucking a plan to go have lunch with your friend. You have to do it in a week in advance, and that's crazy to me. So I've really been starting to feel fucking pretty lonely, to keep it 100 with you guys. Like, and I'm getting at an age where like I'm not trying to fuck around with like random chicks as much, like, because it's boring, it's stupid. Like, I don't know. It seems weird for a dude my age to be like still chasing after the same fucking 20-year-old pussy that I have been for the last however long. Like, I'm just getting over it, and it's wearing on me. I've been going to the gym a lot to try and stay sane. I kind of Facebooked about this the other day, but I feel like it's just funny in my life where when I'm fat and out of shape, it's like, that's obviously when I've been like the most busy and the happiest, because I'm like, ugh, whatever. I don't need to go to the gym. I'm having fun right now. I look good. I don't give a fuck. Like, I'm out here. And then when I am going to the gym constantly, that means that like I literally have nothing else to do. So for the last like 3 weeks, I haven't really been working that much. And like I said, the podcast has been at a stalemate. So my whole days have consisted of like waking up, sending a bunch of emails, going to the gym, coming home, and then like maybe I'll go out at night once a week. But I've been like in a weird antisocial space too. So like now when I do go out, folks are like, oh, what's up, bro? Do you even lift? Like, what the fuck, bro? Do you even lift? Like, joking, because apparently I look big right now. But that just makes me feel like a douchey jock, and I hate that shit. So then it makes me crazier, and then I fucking want to go to the gym more. And now I'm scared that I'm going to turn out to be like a fucking, like that weirdo that I don't know. I don't want to look like a jock, but I can't help it because physical activities are the only thing keeping me sane right now. My wallet got stolen the other day. And that's a bitch. I feel like you don't realize how much shit you keep in your wallet, but like my whole fucking life was in there. And I'm stupid, and I don't know, because I don't lose wallets. Like, I haven't lost a wallet since I was in fourth grade. So I had like my social security card in there, all my credit cards. Like, I had a bunch of random shit in there. And apparently you're not supposed to keep your social security card in your wallet. So, you know, I had to like call 3 major credit bureaus and put a hold on my credit and all this like adult shit that I didn't want to deal with. And then beyond that, just trying to find like a new wallet. I've never had to like buy an adult wallet for myself. So like just, and I'm very like, you know, I'm very picky about what I wanted. So I had to do a lot of internet research to figure out the perfect wallet for me. Just such a hassle, man. But yeah, I don't know. Sorry. I've been feeling very emo lately, and I just have a lot of shit to rant about. Also, I want to say rest in peace to one of my friends, a dude named Tim Lewis back home, recently passed away. He was only 35 and he died of a massive heart attack, apparently. It's very sad. I've known him since I was in first grade. He was one of the first kids that I met up there, him and his brother Spencer. We fucking took karate class together when we were kids, man. Like, and he used to make beats and rap. He was really great to me up there. When I would go home, I had been moved away for a long time, and I started making music, and here I was, this goofy fucking white kid trying to rap, and Tim was up there and was doing music in Alaska. And when I would come home, he got it. He was like, damn, dog, like, this shit is tight, you know, fucking mad lyrical, real hip hop type shit. And, I don't know. So I'm sending my blessings to his family, and, you know, I hope that his mom and dad and his brother Spencer are holding their head high. I talked to a lot of people that went to the funeral. It's very sad. I don't feel like I'm old enough to be going through a fucking age where like my friends are dying and my dad is sick and all this shit. Like, it's just crazy to me. Like, I'm really starting to have like this existential crisis of like, oh fuck, I'm like really an adult now. And the crazy thing is like monetarily I'm great right now. Like, this is the first time in my life that I'm like, not only am I not broke, but I'm so not broke that I've put away a shit ton of money this year. And like, it's crazy to me. Like, I think about how fucking uninspired I am to write raps right now, and I look at it as like, oh wait, a lot of it is because I'm like literally not hungry right now. Like, I can go out and fucking spend $100 on a meal if I wanted to right now. And then I think about dudes like Eminem, where it's like, you know, everybody talks about how much he fell off and this, that, and the other. And it's like, oh, well, no shit. Like, when he was writing his best records, like, he was literally fucking starving. And like, then he became rich and shit changed. And I'm like, damn, like, if I'm only like this minimally comfortable monetarily and I'm having trouble like finding inspiration, it's like, I can't even imagine what a dude like that was going through. Yeah. Rest in peace, Tim Lewis. Very sad to hear about that. And, yeah, hopefully I feel better soon. I'm sure I will. I'm going to go visit my nephews today after I record this and hang out at the beach, and that always cheers me up. So this week on the podcast, we have my dude Jensen Karp. who I've talked about in probably the last 3 out of 4 episodes, because I did his podcast called Get Up On This and I love it. And then we had his artist that he manages, Nova Rockefeller, on the show. And then we had some dudes, some comedy guys that I'm a fan of, It's The Real, on the show. And I didn't even know that they knew him, but they used to do a podcast together called The Hype Men. And so he like told them, oh yeah, you should do his show. So anyway, his name keeps getting brought up. So I figured, hey, it's about time we have him on the show. And so he came in and we talk about, he's kind of lived a lot of life. We're the same age for all intents and purposes. But he like did the whole music industry thing at the time he was 20. Like he got signed when he was 13 and was kind of like in that studio system making a record. And I don't know, he's got a lot of crazy stories and insider stuff about the music industry. And then he went on and when he realized the music wasn't working, he just kept it going and kept hustling. And you know, a lot of rappers talk about being hustlers. And to me, that's the true definition, is like, to be a hustler is to like figure out when one avenue is failing, you get the fuck up and you find another avenue to make money off of. And I think that's it. He sets a great example for that. And I try to do that in my own life. And so, you know, I find him to be not only a really cool guy, but also is very inspirational. Just how he keeps moving. So, I think this episode will interest a lot of you guys. And like I said, if you enjoy this podcast and you're into listening to podcasts and this one a week isn't enough for you, his is another great one to check out. So without further ado, let's get into the podcast with my dude, Jensen Karp. Thank you guys for tuning in. So you're going to SummerSlam today?
I am, yeah.
That'll be fun.
Well, you know, I worked there for 7 months.
No, I didn't. What, like writing stories and stuff?
Yeah.
When was that?
Right after Hot Carl.
Really?
Yeah.
So in your like mid-20s or early 20s?
2005. Yeah. So middle 20s.
That's tight.
Well, it was weird because like once you're done rapping, it's like that moment of what the fuck am
what
I going to
do?
Yeah. And so I was always a writer. That was what I did for a living. Mm-hmm. So an agent or somebody was like, here's a list of things that are looking for writers. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a bunch of shitty sitcoms. And then in the middle was just WWE Raw.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I'll fucking do that.
Were you a fan as a kid?
Oh yeah. I was a fan when I was reading the paper. Like when I was like, oh, that job's available. I was watching.
Yeah.
So it was perfect. And so they reached out and I sent in a resume and two samples of like storylines and dialogue from wrestlers. And I knew I got it. You know, like I sent in a resume that said 4 months ago, I opened for Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
It's like, there's no way they're not going to hire me.
Right, right, right.
And so, yeah, I worked there for about six months.
Yeah.
In Stamford, Connecticut.
So you had to move to Connecticut to write.
Yeah, I moved to Connecticut.
Wow.
And every time a wrestler came out and screamed into the camera, it was, you know, one of us six guys wrote it.
No shit. There's only six of you that write the whole thing?
Yeah, but then there's like some wrestlers that are involved. Like at the time, Dusty Rhodes and Ted DiBiase and somebody else. Ted DiBiase, Dusty Rhodes, and we had Michael Hayes.
Uh-huh.
Those guys were writers with us. They're former wrestlers.
Yeah.
But then on top of that, there were producers, like road agents, and those guys do all the physicality.
Okay.
So like Ricky Steamboat or Arn Anderson or these fucking names that made me want to die every day that I was around them. They would sort of write the physicality.
That's crazy. So, yeah. I mean, would wrestlers get mad at you for their storylines or
well,
anything?
Well, it's weird. No one really gets mad because you have a lot of power in your hands.
Uh-huh.
Some weird stuff about the WWE that I only learned when I worked there is that where you sit on the bill, you get paid differently. So like boxing. So if you're a main eventer, you get a lot more money from the pull.
Yeah.
So kissing ass of the writers is a big deal.
Right. Because
if they can creatively put you in the stories more, you make more money. You also get a percentage of merch.
Yeah.
So the better you are and the more popular you are, you make more money. So they were mostly kissing your ass.
Yeah. But some of that has to go beyond ass kissing. Like sometimes I would imagine that like someone's charm actually just has a lot to do
Absolutely.
With like whether the audience likes them. And if the audience likes them, you guys probably want to write about them.
I mean, that's the goal.
Yeah.
But like The Rock and, you know, there were always wrestlers. I mean, I wasn't there when The Rock was there,
yeah.
But when I was there, there was a guy named, I mean, he still wrestles, but I don't think he's at WWE, but a guy named MVP who did jail time in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got into wrestling after he got out and he would do these promos from the developmental league, from like the AAA.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just like, would like jump out of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So immediately it didn't matter if they kissed our ass or whatever. It mm-hmm. was like, well, that guy's a star.
Mm-hmm.
So he got called up and we worked through, and CM Punk's another example of a guy that when I was there was in developmental and it just sort of was like, that guy's a star.
Right.
And that shit was happening
while
you know, repeatedly.
Yeah.
But working for Vince, I mean, working for Vince McMahon was like, a huge influence on me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And being with Jimmy Iovine before that, it's like working with billionaires. Like,
right.
It's like a very form shaping experience.
Right, right, yeah. Right. That's something that most people never get to be around.
No, I feel like. It's very weird.
Yeah. What, so is it going to be like a class reunion when you go back today? Is it going to feel like going back to your old school?
Or I don't think so. Yeah. Most of those people, I mean, the turnover rate is so fast there. So the only people that'll still be there is like maybe an announcer or like, you know, I'll run into someone every once in a while. And someone on Twitter, you know, this guy, Paul Heyman, who, created ECW, now is in WWE, he's an icon. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while on Twitter, he'll say something nice. And that feels like my reunion.
Yeah.
It feels just like, we weren't ready for the genius of Jensen at WWE yet or something. He'll write something nice like that. And it's just like, that's enough for me.
Nice little validation.
Yeah, that's the pat on the back I need as an only child.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Like when you say you're a writer, like when did the writing start? Like,
since I was little.
Because I feel like some people know you as Hot Carl.
Yeah.
That was your music industry thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of rapping has to do with writing, and writing is
for me, you know, all of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
It,
yeah. So, you know, when did you start writing as a child?
As a kid. Yeah. I mean, they always splintered into two different ways, which is weird for me. Cause I think rap to me, because I was raised on Slick Rick and Third Base and a lot of groups that were kind of joking, you know, Biz Markie and those guys, like I sort of always was like, well, I'm going to get out a lot of my jokes through hip hop.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to write more emotional stuff, which is what I did growing up. So like the stuff that got me the most attention in elementary school writing, cause I was kind of like a heralded writer in my elementary school, was mostly like emotional stories about baseball or my parents or my grandparents, or I wrote this long thing about the Contra-Iran hearing, like a bunch of stuff as a really young kid that was like above my years.
Intense.
But none of that shit was funny.
Right.
So, but then when I wrote raps, even in third grade, they were all jokes.
Yeah.
So, you know, in third grade I did You Be Illin. I grew up in a, when I say predominantly, it's an understatement. I grew up in a white neighborhood, Calabasas, California, which is now, you know,
The Kardashians,
right? But you know, that's a newer thing. So even though NWA lived in Calabasas and I grew up around, you know, Ice Cube and these guys, it was a 99% white neighborhood.
And Calabasas is kind of like an entertainment neighborhood, right?
Yeah. Well, people move there when they get rich.
Yeah, right, right.
I grew up in Woodland Hills, which is next door. It's not rich, but my parents knew it was a good school district, so they lied about my address and stuff.
Right.
So I would go to Calabasas.
Yeah.
But when growing up, it's like even when I would rap or bring tapes to school, no one even knew what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I did UB Illin for my third grade talent show, a teacher asked my mother what that music is.
Yeah.
So I was just always into it, and so I started writing around then, both creatively on the emotional side and then on the right side is just hip hop. And then when it became bar mitzvah time, like seventh grade, I didn't get a bar mitzvah, although I look like a bagel. but basically, there were, at a bar mitzvah, I had to kind of hide my rap love. I know this sounds weird now because like everyone looks like who I grew up with rapping.
Yeah.
But at the time, no, you know, one guy, the football quarterback one time told me to stop writing because this is for black people. And so I didn't hide it, but the only time it would come out is when a kid transferred. This is so weird. I think about this a lot. A kid would transfer to my high school from like an inner city school,
mm-hmm.
and he would say he rapped. And then my white friends, my like football white friends, would then wheel me out to battle him.
Oh, shit.
And it happened all the time.
Yeah.
And I'd always win, and I'd always destroy him. And that was the only time I really showed off. Girls barely even knew I rapped. It wasn't something I did to get laid or anything. It was like a parlor trick.
Right, right.
So at this bar mitzvah, I was mimicking the words to a Black Sheep song.
Uh-huh.
And a guy came up to me and was like, if I give you a microphone, will you rap? And like, I've always sounded like this. I've always been a white guy.
Yeah.
Like, I know that's weird to say, but it's like I always saw hip hop as not my culture.
Yeah. So, but you weren't doing the Iggy Azalea where you were trying to put on a fucking
murder
draw.
Business. Yeah, no, I never did any of that. Yeah. And I think that actually affected my career at the time. And this guy came up, gave me the microphone and I just did it and murdered it. And, he was like, I want to introduce you to someone. And then he introduced me to Rhyme Syndicate.
And this was when you were 13?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I basically, Donald D managed me, you know, all these Rhyme Syndicate names, you know, Henji, all these Charlie Jam, all these names that were like Ice-T's group started managing this white rapper from the Valley. I had the one black kid from my middle school also rapped with me. So we were already in a group. So I brought him along and, we signed a management deal with Donald D
at 13. That's so crazy. But having listened to your podcast, I became a fan of your podcast after I heard about it. And so I listen now and then I've learned that you were also like, you were in some child acting stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I was, on a show called Kid Songs.
So,
which is by the way, where I learned most black culture.
Yeah.
That was the only place I knew black, basically Kid Songs was Barney without the dinosaur. It was like a Disney show.
Yeah.
And now you look at it and I look crazy gay. It's amazing to watch. I don't hide from it.
Yeah.
And so, but that was where I was around black kids. There was a lot of black kids in Kid Songs. And so when they were handing me, you know, my cousin would give me Third Base and Stetsasonic and stuff, but these kids were showing me more the pop stuff because we were all 11, you know, or whatever age we were.
And so, like MC Hammer?
MC Hammer, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But not Can't Touch This. Let's Get It Started.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, Let's Get It Started. Fresh Prince and In This Corner. You know, those kind of things that were pop were more from them.
Yeah.
And dancing, which was a big thing then, you know, you couldn't just really rap.
Yeah, you had to be an entertainer.
Yeah, so I was dancing, you know.
Of course,
we all were. So that was where I learned it from this Kid Song show.
Nice, nice. Yeah.
Well, and also made out with a black girl.
Fantastic, yeah. That's a big achievement in a white man's
Calabasas,
life.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I'm the only kid who could ever say that.
How did your folks end up in Woodland Hills? Are they from out here? Are they from the East Coast?
My mother is from here. My mom's from Whittier, and then Montebello, Whittier. And my father was from Brooklyn, and he moved here for business and met my mom, who is this, you know, Miss California runner-up and model and shit.
Get out.
Yeah, he owned like a jean company, so he used to run, I mean, it sounds so scummy now, but it was the 70s, but he used to run fake ads in the paper.
Yeah,
because he had a very successful jean company that kind of fell apart, but he used to put ads in the paper that was like looking for a model, but he like never was looking for a model.
It was just like looking for dates.
Yeah,
that was early MySpace.
Yeah, real early. Real thirsty. And so my mom comes and he's like, "You're hired," but had no job. Yeah. So he made up an assistant job.
Nice.
And just was like, "Yeah, you're an assistant," and then they just started dating
and it worked it out,
and then they fucked and had me.
That's fantastic.
Yep.
You got brothers and sisters?
Zero.
Your only child.
Only child.
So do you think that's where some of the like look at me comes from?
It's
like
from where all of it's from.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, validation as an only child seems key. I don't know. I mean, this is what I think about probably about 80% of my day is what not having a brother. My father passed 5 years ago and I realize not having anyone to bounce anything off. My parents divorced later too, but it's like you don't have an outlet to just get your brother sister shit out.
Right.
So you're just sort of like, be my brother.
Yeah.
Be my sister. You sort of have that about a lot of different people, especially people you date.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel that. Does it make you, it makes you seek like more people to be part of your brain trust or something?
Not more, but it makes you seek people to be part of your brain trust. Yeah. You don't really have a team.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're looking for a team.
Right. Right.
My team was the Rhyme Syndicate.
Yeah. Did your dad stay in the gene business? Like,
no,
was that his thing?
No, he did a million things. He was really a car salesman most of my life.
Okay.
We weren't raised with a ton of money.
How did they realize like, oh wait, our child needs to be on TV? Or was that,
I
was
wanted
that
to.
You?
No, it was me. They didn't want that. No, they didn't. As soon as I said I didn't want to do it anymore, I didn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
So like I was in like an American Express commercial and stuff. I never really broke, but like as soon as I was like, I want to play Little League more. So I focused on Little League.
Yeah.
But I got out.
How
really
did you
early.
Find out about Kid Songs? Like,
I think it was just a call.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just like, cause I was, hip hop was, you know, I was the only kid with raps, white kid that, with raps on his resume.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Kid Songs had me come in and
so you were rapping on Kid Songs?
No, I was singing.
Okay.
But I mean, I think they just wanted anyone who was like, you know, musical
at
that age.
Who could keep a rhythm.
Yeah. And so I went in and it was like a dance. It was like a audition where you danced and I was fucking great.
Right.
So I just did it and got the call.
Yeah. Did you guys used to have like youth center dances and stuff like that?
No. Well, I know. I mean, we had dances, but there was like six kids who could dance in my school and I was one of them. And
I was one of them in mine too.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where like we had youth center dances and there was dance competition.
Oh yeah. We had that too.
Yeah. And the thing that I don't know if kids still do this these days, but like the best thing was slow dancing. Like I loved
fuck.
Yeah,
now,
exactly.
I mean,
now you're just all daggering and shit, but like, man,
could
as
you
a kid,
imagine? Jesus.
Dude. Yeah. I would have cleaned
I
up.
I was like so stoked if we just even touched like
we used to call it freak dancing,
right? Or freaking.
Yeah, freaking.
Freaking.
Like, girls would be like, "Oh, Lee's so good at freaking." So, like, I would have a line.
That's gonna be on your tombstone.
Oh, I hope, dude.
At freaking.
There was one year I broke my ankle. One year, and so the beginning of the school year, I was on crutches the whole time and dancing with one leg, but like freaking with one leg.
So dope.
And there's like a picture.
They can't hold you down,
dude. There's a picture in my eighth grade yearbook of like me freaking a girl standing on one leg with other girls waiting to do it. It's
Whoa.
Like legendary.
That's so dope.
Yeah, I need to do a fucking Instagram post of that.
That's so good. Yeah. I think it was like, I performed when we did the Rhyme Syndicate thing during sort of the freak years, we performed at a dance with, my high school was well known for rock bands. So we had Incubus, members of Linkin Park.
Mm-hmm.
We had, Hoobastank was next door, a lot of, you know, rock bands.
Yeah.
And so, we performed with Incubus's little brother's band, which had a bunch of members that were actually real brothers to Incubus called, they were called like the Tourists then, and then became Audiovent. They signed a deal and released a record. And so we performed like before them. And I think like halfway through, it just was like, fuck rap was the chant.
Yeah.
And we finished our set and I was like, well, it's still that school.
Yeah.
And so, but then you're right. Like dancing, I think crossed the border.
Yeah.
But I think I also was kind of like a freak. I think people didn't, especially those years, like black culture, man, it was just like not, it just wasn't in my school. So if they saw me like, you know, doing the kid and play, I think it was sort of a, what is he doing?
Right.
It's also like, there was like a wigger thing.
But that's the thing. I couldn't imagine you being like a Malibu's Most Wanted type.
I was
like,
never.
You probably weren't playing up that kind of
shit. No, but I wore cross colors and I wore like the long shorts. And I think I just sort of, I mean, even though I talked like this, I think people, it was still too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so,
which is so funny because that's all it is now.
Yeah, that's
like
all
every
it
rapper
is.
Looks like that.
Well, I mean, the biggest pop star, Justin Bieber, like that's his thing.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
And Macklemore. Yeah, I mean, it just goes G-Eazy. It just goes on and on.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, for sure.
It's weirder when there's a black rapper on the radio now. I'm not kidding. It's weirder.
It's terrible.
Like when there's a pop radio song with a new young black rapper. When is that happening?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's true.
It's not happening.
That's true.
Yeah,
it's a trying time to be a white rapper. Well, like I think about this. Like right now, white rap. Like there's a big backlash against it, you know what I mean? And for someone like me that's been doing it for a decade plus, it's like so disheartening to be like, oh fuck, here I am out of fashion again.
Yeah, it's very weird.
It ebbs and flows, you know what I mean? Like you go in and out of fashion as a white rapper, but
yeah. Well, anyway. I was in the early days.
Yeah, no, that's actually what I was going to say is I'm surprised because from the outside perspective, having not known the backstory, but like being heavy into hip hop in the late 90s when Eminem became a thing, I was like, and then I heard of Hot Carl and I was like, oh, this is like a reactionary thing where a label went, oh, we have this Eminem guy that's going to blow up. We better get somebody to match him. That's what I thought. I didn't realize
it was the same label.
That's crazy. Yeah. I didn't realize that you guys like, or that you had been signed since you were 13. That's insane.
Well, then I left.
Yeah.
And then I took off for a while. And then I went to USC for writing.
Uh-huh.
I was going to be I was going to do what I do now, which was just write comedy.
Yeah.
And, on the way home, from a job I had, I was at the Flintstones. I was an intern on the Flintstones 2 movie.
Oh yeah.
I was interning for the director. I was like his assistant. And on the radio, they were like, we're taking contestants for the roll call, which is on the radio, which I don't know if you remember in LA. It was like,
I wasn't here.
So there was like this contest on the radio, the Baca Boys, who are the sort of like, you know, iconic radio DJs out here in LA. They used to have a contest that they created and it ended up going different regions.
What channel is that on?
They did both. They did Power and they did The Beat.
Okay.
So those were the two urban stations growing up. And so you would call in, they would be like, it's the roll call, who's on the line? And then you would do 4 bars back, and then they would chant where you're from, basically. That's the second part. And then you would have it's 4 and 4.
Yeah.
And it's a battle.
Yeah.
There's 6 people on the phone and a victor emerges.
Yeah.
And I had done it when I was 13. I had done it when I was a kid and won only like a day in a row, never had a real string.
Right.
And at fucking 19, I was just sort of like, that's funny.
Yeah.
And so I called in. And I was on my way home and the guy was like, okay, rap. And so I said something funny and he was like, you're on. I was like, okay.
Nice.
He goes, what's your name? And I had not thought of that.
Yeah.
It was not something that came up in my
mind. Yeah,
And so I was in college and I had heard someone just a couple days ago say what a hot Carl.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is that? And he's like, oh, it's when you shit on someone's chest during sex. Right. And I was like, what a funny rap name. Like that was immediately what came to my mind when I'm talking to him. I was like, because you battle. All I did was battle growing up. So it's like, I was like, that's kind of what you do in a battle.
Yeah.
And
shit
then,
on people.
But the funny part is as soon as he said, what's your name? That's what came out.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to say Jensen in case I blew it.
Right.
And so, cause I'm the only Jensen.
Yeah.
And so, I just said, Hot Carl, I won the first day. You keep going. So I won the second day, the third day I win, the fourth day I'm driving to work. And on the radio, the Baca Boys go, everybody's calling about the same thing. And I was like, okay, it's some new song from Quick or somebody. Yeah. And they were like, Hot Carl will be back on at 6. And I was like, what the fuck? That was the first time that I realized something was happening.
Yeah.
And so at the end of that week, they started inviting me into the studio to do it. I walked in and it was like even a bigger story.
They're like,
what the fuck? You know, I was like a nerd.
Yeah.
So it just quickly became like, you know, LA radio legend. And I won 40 something days in a row.
Wow.
Yeah.
Out of those 40 days, there's gotta be somebody that was legendary.
Yeah.
No?
Well, I mean, people that are legendary, like with us, but not like, I don't, it's funny. Like when I met Anwar and the Peas and Carrots kids, those guys were like, one of them was like, I went up against you. I think Josh did.
Yeah.
But like a couple, every once in a while, someone will be like, I went against you. And you're like, oh, that's funny.
Really?
But like, I've heard weird stuff about who was a fan of that, that went on. But I mean, if you were like an LA radio guy. There was no iPod. There was no satellite radio. Yeah. So mostly everyone was listening. And at the end of those 40 something days, I retired on my own as sort of the champion of all time.
Yeah.
And I walked off and Jimmy Iovine had a big fucking novelty check for me.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing. What was it like during those 40 days in a row?
It was insane. It was crazy. I would go to a restaurant and I would hear people talking about it like two things down.
Yeah.
And
would you ever seek that validation and go, hey, that's
no,
me.
It was a different person. Yeah. It's so Zelig. It's so Forrest Gump. It was like, it was a phone call I made on the way home from work. So it wasn't, and I had to do it before I started going in the studio. I would lock myself in the script room, and do it over the phone.
Yeah.
Like I had a job.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Eventually when the check was offered to me from Jimmy, I just went up to Brian Levant, who I still talk to, the director. And I was like, I can't work here anymore. Yeah. I'm rapping.
I got a dip.
I got a huge deal.
And so then what happens?
You record an album.
Yeah.
They threw money at me.
Yeah.
Anytime I wanted anything.
Because this was still at the time when like labels had money to fucking blow.
Yeah. I mean, Blink 182 sold 10 million records.
Yeah.
Kid Rock sold 11 million records.
Yeah.
I mean, the Bloodhound Gang sold 3 million. I mean, it was just a different era.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
And so they were just throwing money at me, especially watching what was happening with them in the early days. And they were just like, well, we have another one.
While you were doing the 40-day streak, was Eminem a thing already?
It was sort of just popping off.
Like My Name Is had just come out or something?
My Name Is was out. And but it was like, it was still sort of like, is this a one-hit rap wonder?
Right.
And then around the time that I was halfway done with the album, someone sent me Stan.
Oh,
and
wow.
I remember being like, Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being like, oh, I'm not, this is not coming out.
Right.
Because as soon as I realized, oh, he can write his ass, you know, he can, it wasn't just a hit.
Yeah.
I was like, well, that's not going to work.
Right.
And I knew it pretty much immediately, but I had worked this album. You can get on iTunes under Hot Carl. It's like, you know, it's me and Kanye and Will.i.am and Fabolous and Redman and Maya. And it's just like,
you got Kanye on there?
I do. DJ Quick.
That's crazy.
There's just a million people on this record.
Producing
working
and rapping? Or just
no, producing. He wasn't a rapper.
He wasn't a rapper yet.
No. I mean, he was, but no one was listening
to him. So you were just getting people up on that.
Yeah. Well,
that's crazy.
Well, I didn't like it. Yeah. So I shouldn't say that.
Really?
Well, I just thought he was breathy.
Yeah.
If you listen back now, it's like, I was friends with him. We were close.
Yeah.
During the time he sounded like a mace with asthma.
Yeah.
I didn't get his punchlines because I couldn't understand them.
Right.
As soon as I started to hear him do that, a better voice, I was like, oh, he's a good rapper. But I have a song with Redman and Fabolous where on the hook, it's just yelling, blow. And my manager at the time was like, Kanye wants to rap on it. And I was like, I don't like Kanye's rapping.
Wow.
Like, it's not, I mean, I blew it. Terrible hindsight.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but he's the guy yelling blow.
Oh, no shit.
So it's like, because he was just hanging out in the studio and I was like, well, let him yell the hook.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. But he also produced a song with me called Armando Sante that's on the album.
What was it like in the studios during that time?
So ridiculous.
Like, I mean, how many songs did you write while you were incubating in the system?
Probably 20 something.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first couple were really fun. It was like, you know, I have a song with MC Search that was my hero growing up. So, like those kind of things were really fun. C-minus produced that, like people that I really like being around. But then once it starts becoming a thing where you're paying $15,000 for Maya to sing on, it was like, this feels terrible.
Right.
And now in 2014, that's not really happening as much. You kind of have to be friends with the person and you at least have to have some connection.
Right.
And
it has to make sense.
Yeah. Back then there was no sense. And then I had 15 producers work on 15 songs.
Wow.
It was just nothing sounded coherent.
Yeah. So, and when you got signed and you start making the album, was it always kind of like a, I'm going to be a character type thing or
it was a character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if I was myself, it's like, I was going to be myself.
Yeah.
All my values, all that stuff was going to my, was never going to act to be someone else. But Hot Carl was always going to be a slightly outlandish,
like punchline
battler,
funny.
Right. He was going to be a battler. So it was like, I made fun of Tyrese in 8 of 15 songs. I don't even care about Tyrese.
Right.
His name just rhymed with beef.
Yeah.
And the thing is I did that on the radio and then he took offense and then called in and all this, you know, there was a lot of weird shit that happened on the radio during this sort of like mega
boom.
Offense
and called in?
Yeah.
About you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's because his name rhymed with beef.
Yeah.
And that was it. The only reason. So me putting him in 15 of songs is not, it's not really me.
Right.
I don't really give a fuck about Tyrese.
Right.
It's just,
more shots fired, Tyrese.
Yeah,
go ahead and call in.
Call in here. He's like, listen, man, I'm very strange, but I hate Hot Carl. but he, like, that's not a real thing.
Right.
That's the only character I took on.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, if you, myself, I'm not going to talk in third person, but my real name was a different thing. And then Hot Carl was a little more outlandish.
If Hot Carl would have caught on, do you think it would have, would you have eventually like dropped the character and
absolutely.
Rapped?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd always said that eventually it would just be HK and I wouldn't. I thought about this cause I knew I was doing your show and I know what the podcast is about.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's weird. In the decade since that happened.
Yeah.
I've grown up so much.
Right.
So when you listen to the Hot Girl album now, you sort of go, well, it was 2001.
Yeah.
I don't think that. Uh-huh. I listen to it and I think to myself, oh, well, I was trying to commercially break.
Yeah.
I was making a commercial rap album.
Yeah.
I was an MC. There was no one who heard me that said I couldn't rap. That was never a fucking thing. I could always rap my ass off. The decisions I was making, it's weird. It's almost like it's because I respected hip hop that I tried to go that way.
Yeah.
Because for me, there was no Def Jux, really.
You know,
Eastern Conference was just coming together. Everything was just coming together. The only way I really had a legitimate voice in hip hop was to go pop.
Right.
To go the other way, there was no real precedence.
Right.
M became that precedence. But I didn't really want to tarnish the art.
Right.
And it wasn't my culture to steal. I was not going to co-opt it. I would have only made my own lane. And I feel that that's what the Hot Girl thing was. Looking back, it's not really me. Mm-hmm. It's me with everything I meant to say.
Mm-hmm.
But I now when you listen to stuff that I do, whether it's the Clippers halftime song or the stuff that I'll do with Nova now, where I just show up on stuff like that's, it sounds like Jensen. It sounds like the real me.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time I had, it was a product.
Yeah.
Which I don't diss, but that's what it was.
Well, I mean, it was so early in your life, too. Like, I look back.
I was 20.
Dude, when you're 20, like, you don't know shit.
You have no
yet.
Voice.
You don't know shit.
Yeah. Like, I had a song called Fat Girls that I was demoing for the record deal.
Yeah.
I demoed a song called Fat Girls. And I listen to it now, and I just want to punch myself in the face.
Right, because fat girls are the most fun to fuck.
Yeah, at least I say that in there for the record. But it's just like, And it was funny because at shows I would see heavier girls rapping along and loving it. And I think they got the humor of it. But it wasn't me. But this outlandish sort of character that really wasn't a great connection to hip-hop.
Did you say faggot on the record?
Not on the record.
That was like a thing. Like, wasn't offensive. Like, not that it wasn't offensive. It was super offensive. But like, people used to do that a lot on records.
The Flavor Unit. So, by the way, for people who don't know me, I also have obsessive compulsive disorder to a very high degree, and I've put most of it into hip hop. So I know a lot, like you do. I know a lot about hip hop. So it's not just that I had a record deal at 19. Mm-hmm. I've studied this like a fucking monster.
You're a student.
Yeah. So, like the Flavor Unit album has that song "Roll with the Flavor" on it, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it's a posse song. Mm-hmm. With everyone, Latifah and Tretch and Drez and all these guys. And Chip Foo is on it. And he says, Chip, something, Fushnikin's stomping faggots, dun, 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 Inspector Gadget.
Oh,
I remember loving that line so much.
Right.
And then now looking back, I'm like,
God,
he rhymed faggot with Inspector Gadget.
Yeah.
That's crazy bad offensive.
Insane.
He could have done a million different things.
Right.
But with M and all those guys who were doing it, it just meant something else until around 2000, probably 11.
And now it's Same Love, you know?
Yeah. Now it's a completely different. Now Queen Latifah still won't come out, but at least she's involved in something that talks about gay.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's funny. She's on that song.
I know. That's
She's
what
on the Flavian song.
I wonder if she like checked him like, hey, come on, man. Like,
I think she was probably not checking anyone in her weird pantsuit. I think she's probably just like, very funny line. I don't think she still doesn't admit it. She lived with her trainer for 15 years.
Right.
I don't know why she needed a female roommate.
No, I know. That's like my mom is close friends with an old art teacher that I had. I'm not going to say her name, but she was a great art teacher. And she lived with her quote unquote roommate.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, does so-and-so still teach up there? And she goes, you know what? She and her roommate moved
so weird.
To some other state. I'm like, why do you say roommate? Like, she was a lesbian.
Girlfriend.
Mom, like, just like, it's cool. It's her girlfriend. It's, you know,
I mean, Queen Latifah has no, by the way, I made fun of Latifah so much on Hot Girl album. I mean, to a point where my first single, the first line is something's changed. Let's go toe for toe. Cause nobody's watching you like Queen Latifah's talk show,
oof.
Which was a joke then.
Yeah.
And it's still a joke because now she got a new show.
There you go.
But she, like, she has no responsibility to come out to the hip hop community.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's up to her, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It's her choice, but it would really help. And I think that, you know, maybe the Macklemore thing she thinks was the unspoken, hey, I'm obviously gay, but just, it would help everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I feel like there's no point in hiding that sort of stuff anymore.
No need.
Whatever. Anyway, to get back to where we were.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like, that shit happened too early? Like, do you still have a passion for rapping where you're like,
I
wish that I would have just like waited and done this now?
No. If I was 19 now, maybe.
Yeah.
But now, no. 34, I love writing. I did a remix on Nova song, and then I did the Clippers halftime song last year.
Oh, no shit.
So those things feel great.
Yeah.
But I'm also completely phobic of touring.
Right.
So there's a lot of things where I would have been an addict touring. So those kind of things, I could never have done. So there are parts of me that go, well, thank God that didn't happen. I also really found my passion. I mean, I knew my passion was writing.
Yeah.
So when I got out of rap, I was like, the only other thing that makes me feel that adrenaline is writing.
Yeah.
So now I'm writing for Rolling Stone and the hundreds and I'm working on a book and stuff. So, those type of things bring me the same feeling.
That's great.
Yeah.
Did the rap thing happen, during college?
Yes.
Oh, did you drop out of college?
No, they let me stay. Yeah. I actually transferred. I went to Arizona for a year and a half or something and I transferred to USC. And
how was that?
Arizona or the transfer?
Arizona.
I mean, it's just like a huge fuck fest.
Yeah,
it's a little weird.
Yeah, it seems strange out there.
It was, I mean, it's fun. I was 17.
Oh, okay.
So it was like a blast.
Did you graduate a little early or something?
In high school, I was just young.
Oh.
I was young for my grade.
Yeah.
And so, I went out there and then after a while, I was like, this just isn't me. I'm not like a partier. So
you go back to USC?
So I went to USC and then that's when I entered the radio contest. And then going into my senior year, because I had transferred, I had to take 40 units, uh-huh. 20 and 20,
uh-huh.
first and second half.
Uh-huh.
And so I just went into the school and was like, listen, I can show you what I did. Or, you know, there was an article in the LA Times about my deal and stuff.
Yeah.
I said, or I could bring in the LA Times article. I was like, I've done something that has very rarely happened here in USC. I think it was just me and Young MC that signed rap deals while at USC.
Uh-huh.
And so
and they gave you an honorary PhD.
Yeah. No. I'm now a doctor.
Yeah.
And so I was just sort of like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And they were like, well, if you have any problems, come in and talk to us. And they let me sort of, not coast, but I mean, I got to pick the classes I wanted. Mm. I didn't really have as much of a problem getting the classes I wanted, and I did it. And I recorded the album while taking 40 units my senior year. Mostly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the album.
And I brought Bubba Sparks to frat parties.
Amazing. Amazing. The New South is in the house. Yeah. The album's finished. Does it instantly come out? Do you get shelved? What happens?
Oh, I got completely shelved.
Yeah, so what happens?
So I finished the record, what I think is finished the record. They put out like a couple promotional vinyl stuff. The Search song comes out. I think there was talk of me going in with Timbaland to remake a song that got me the deal, a song called Caliente Carlito.
Uh-huh.
And, I was excited and ready. And then it just froze. Everything just sort of stopped happening. And I mean, I'm smart enough to see it and I had seen it happen to other people. So I was just sort of like, oh, you're all not looking at me as much. And like, no one's looking me in the eyes when they're talking to me. And it was just a very weird vibe. So immediately I just sort of had my manager be like, is this writing on the wall? They sort of said no, and I just felt it and was like, well, I'm asking for out of my deal.
Yeah.
And Jimmy, and I had such a weird thing, but Jimmy Iovine, I wrote a script while I was sort of bumming out about this rap thing.
Right.
Before I left the label, I wrote a script, and Jimmy Iovine heard about it through Ari Emanuel, who's the agent that, you know, Jeremy Piven plays in Entourage.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he had gotten his hands on it through someone, and Jimmy calls me and he's like, you know, you wrote this movie. And this is while I'm like waiting for the album to come out.
Yeah.
So I thought it was going in there to talk about my album.
Yeah.
He's like, you wrote this movie and Ari Emanuel told me, and I just, we're working on this 8 Mile for Eminem and I'm looking for a comedy follow-up. And I was like, are you fucking joking?
A comedy follow-up?
I was like, he was just like, for a second movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, so
but not like a sequel to 8 Mile.
No. Oh, just okay. He's trying to make more movies.
Just make another movie.
And I was just like, wait, so you're calling me in to talk about my script. My album is dead.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, you know, maybe it's time. And I always remember this. He's like, maybe it's time to go Gerardo, which is a sort of verb at Interscope for when they turn you into an A&R.
Whoa.
Because Gerardo became an A&R after Rico Suave.
Rico Suave.
Right. And so I was like, what? And he was like, I'm going to send you home with like 7 CDs. And he sent me like mostly all, you know, promos getting ready, you know, in the next year. One was like Fourth Avenue Jones. There were some people in there.
Yeah.
And so he was like, listen.
I used to play shows with them.
I did too.
Yeah, that's fine.
I did too. And so I listened to it and he was like, tell me your thoughts. And then I got home and was like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Like, am I going to become an A&R? We've never even addressed my album. We've never even talked about what happened.
Right.
So I just, the next day I called my lawyer and my manager and said, please get me off the record label.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later I was off the label.
What does that feel like? Was there a sinking pit? Or like you know what I mean? Like, did it feel like breaking up with a girlfriend that you really loved?
No.
No.
And full disclosure, a couple months before I had signed a publishing deal.
Mm-hmm.
So money had not, it was not a problem.
Yeah.
So my mental health was my main concern,
right,
which was I can't sit stagnant waiting for, there was no such thing as do it yourself. There was no YouTube. There was no,
right.
So it was Napster and that was all we had. So I wasn't going to release an album on Napster. And I just mentally was like, I don't want to feel this way.
Yeah.
And also I know I'm creative. I know I can do something else, or I know, you know, I had sort of plan Bs, even though not fully fleshed out, but
right,
I had a plan B idea,
right,
that I'm going to have a plan B.
Right.
And so the publishing deal gave me a lot of freedom. I went in and wrote for a bunch of people. And during that time I was like, I got to do something else. And I opened an art gallery in LA.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what, you know, got me out of the rap business.
The Gallery 1988.
Gallery 1988. Yeah. It was just an idea that friends of mine, whether it was Kanye or DJ AM or people that I was really close with, were spending all this money on sneakers and clothes. And then you'd go to their house and they had like a poster, you know? So the concept was, is to make art that like they can afford
and collect and
collect.
And be a thing.
Yeah. And then a decade later, it's, two locations. We've got two books. I mean, more than two books, probably six books at this point. And, it's really been a successful plan B hobby, and I'm writing the whole time. So
nice.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. So after you open the gallery, and do you get the itch to start writing again, or what happens?
Writing rap or writing?
Just writing.
I think
like,
I never stopped.
Writing the whole time.
I never really stopped.
What were you kind of writing about?
Well, I think I was, I had a blog in the early days when it was just like me and Nick Ketchdubs and Sean Fennessy and all these names of people who have went on to be writers.
Right.
And so John Caramanica, some great people. And we were all sort of this weird little blog circle. And so I was getting it out through that.
Yeah.
And then when Twitter came along, that was where I sort of started getting out my jokes, and my Twitter became popular for jokes, which was cool. And, you know, since then, I've been, you know, the WWE, bunch of things that I just sort of popped up, and I just wrote on the ESPYs. I wrote jokes for Drake.
Yeah. You got to be besties with Drake.
Friends with Drake.
I'm so jealous.
We're very close.
Yeah.
No, we're not. That was a joke. We got along really well. We talked hip hop a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was funny because when I was on your podcast, it was like the week before the ESPYs thing was going to start, and you're like, and I was like, oh my God, I hope you get to become friends with Drake. You're like me too. And
yeah,
I was like,
friends.
Fuck.
We were friends.
I saw the Instagram picture. Like,
he asked to take that picture.
That's amazing.
Which is my claim to fame.
That's amazing.
I would have asked him anyway, but he was like, we need to take a picture.
And
I was like,
amazing.
Drake, we do need to take a picture. And then I just took a picture with him. But he was really fun. I wore a Murder Inc. shirt. Not the one, you know, the Murder Inc. that was supposed to be the super group, which was supposed to be DMX, Ja Rule, and Jay-Z.
Right.
They announced the group, took a photo for Source, and then never did anything.
Yeah.
I have a t-shirt of that promo shot.
Wow.
And so I wore it during a table read, and he just looked at me and gave me sort of a side eye and was like, wow.
He's like, we're going to be friends.
And then we would talk hip hop every once in a while. I talked to him about Shmurda. I talked to him about things that were relevant at the time.
Yeah.
I've kept in touch with a couple people in his circle, and I almost went out for OVO last week. I didn't, but I know you hate me for that. That would have been amazing.
No, that would have been so tight.
He was really great, and he was so funny. And I've never come from the camp that I think he's soft, also because I was really soft.
Yeah, for sure.
But he is a really nice guy.
Well, you know, the thing is, he doesn't write music for people that don't get pussy. You know what I mean? And that's,
please.
We're out here.
We do this. No, he's so nice, and it's fun to write jokes, I'm on a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm on Kevin Smith's pilot this season, and I'm on like three other shows. So
your podcast, Get Up On This.
Yes.
I love it.
Thanks.
I'm a fan. I co-sign it.
Thank you.
I found out about it because of you guys said some kind words about me, but
now
I'm like an actual fan.
Thank you.
But even just talking to you now, like that's a constant theme in your life, is like being early on things.
Yeah, always has been.
Where does that come from?
Why
are people like us like that? Why do we like to be up on things?
Yeah.
Like that's a thing.
Well, the podcast started, I had another podcast with Jeff and Eric Rosenthal from the It's the Real, who were
my previous guests, because we haven't been able to get in the studio for a month.
Great
guys. Awesome. That was
my,
great.
My other brothers. And so we...
The Hype Men.
Yes, the Hype Men. We had become friends, and we decided to do a podcast where we interviewed, and this is before any hip-hop podcast.
Right.
We just started to do hip-hop podcasting with Jess Blaze and A-Track and then Hannibal Buress and a bunch of comedians. We would bring in, you know, a real wide array.
Yeah.
You know, one week we'd have Freddie Gibbs, the next week Paul Scheer.
Yeah.
And it was always about hip-hop.
Yeah.
And so after 50 episodes, it was just becoming tiring because they lived on the East Coast. I live on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And so we sort of disbanded, even though Rolling Stone had named us top 10 things to watch and all this crazy shit that was happening. I was sort of at a point where I was like, what did I like most about Hype Men? Do I want to keep doing a podcast? And Kevin Smith had asked me to maybe come onto his network because he liked what he heard about Hype Men. And I realized that the thing I've liked my whole life is being on top of something before it happens.
Yeah.
I went on Kevin's morning show, and he was like, Jensen's always on top of things. You know, what is it that you like now? And at the time, Turntable FM was out for like a day.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cool idea that didn't work out on the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a cool start for something. And I'm sure we'll see some sort of inclination.
I mean,
later
it seems kind of like places like Spotify and everything.
Yeah,
took, like,
other things have helped. Yeah,
they took
a little bit from it.
Inspiration.
Yeah, and I brought it up on that podcast, and Kevin was like, and then Kevin heard about it from someone else 10 days later.
Yeah.
I was like, he was right. And so that kind of shit, whether it was the Wu-Tang 12-inch for Protect Your Neck, or whether it was, I'm trying to think of other things that aren't hip-hop for you, but Twin Peaks, or whether things that I was always sort of on top of before the rest of my school, and hip-hop being the biggest one.
Yeah.
But that was always something I wanted to do, and I think it's because hip hop spoke to me so young, and I was so ahead of the curve that I was never going to come back to their level.
Right.
So there was never a time, you know, don't get me wrong, I bought the Vanilla Ice record. There are things that I fell into because I was like, well, I need to know stuff about pop culture. But my main focus is, and anyone who went to school with me my whole life will tell you the same thing, is like, I was always trying to sort of find what was next. And I was usually pretty right.
And that's the thing, listening to your podcast, like there's so many things that, that I relate to with your personality and stuff, but like that's the heaviest one. That's like the theme is like, ever since I was a little kid, it's the same thing. I just like to be early on stuff. Yeah. I don't know if that's some sort of like fucking masking a insecurity or something that like to like or placing yourself on a higher plateau of like, oh, I fucking know about this stuff before anybody else. You know, I don't know what it is in my head that makes me want
to
do that.
For me, it's not that. Yeah. That would be very easy for me to admit because I don't have a problem saying that. But my thing is really. I'm excited by your rookie year.
Yeah.
And that's a real that's a real baseball term, obviously. But even when I collected baseball cards as a kid, it's like the rookie card is most important. And I think that was what I was always searching for, which is what's the new rookie card? Yeah. What's this? And you know, still at the same time, I'm a person who celebrates why don't we say Busta Rhymes is top five?
Right.
I also look back and look at things that I think are underrated as well. So I think it's somewhere in between finding that hidden gem before it breaks.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And I think most people would brand it like some sort of hipsterism as like, oh, I knew about that when it was fucking cool, but it's like it's not that. It's just like this unquenchable thirst for like new things.
I like when things break, you know. I think we the reason that the podcast has become popular is because we have a really good track record.
Yeah,
you know, we've gotten people up on things. Our first episode from 155 weeks ago. I said Macklemore.
Yeah,
you know, and that was before anything. That was just when the Nike video came out.
Right,
Chance the Rapper when it had 1,000 views.
Right.
You know, we've done things that you know got the attention not only of the artist, but of the fans to be very early on things. And I'm excited for Chance. I'm very excited for these guys.
Yeah.
I'm excited for people that we brought up early.
Right.
You know, this week we had on Boaz.
Okay. Yeah.
From Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And I think he's well on his way to being a pretty good, good force. And, you know, he reached out to us to do the podcast.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we get celebrated back and I, from what I understand, people who are too busy, we have a lot of actors and comedians who listen to the show, people who are too busy to find it themselves. We're extremely honored to be the people to bring you those things.
Yeah.
So you don't have to look.
Right. Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. And I feel like, the theme of this podcast is similar to that in that like, I love getting people up on shit early. And like, we had Macklemore on our show 3 years ago.
Absolutely.
And he did a song that like broke as a number one hit 2 years later.
It's
crazy. It's crazy as fuck. Yeah. Anyways.
I hope we can say the same thing about Nov.
Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah. And I know people loved the live performances to me are what your podcast is great.
That's what separates it. Absolutely.
I feel even in any case, anytime I've watched any of those performances, they seem very, and this is a bad adjective, but they seem young.
It
seems early.
So
that's a really fun thing.
Well, and actually we've been going through growing pains where like I'm trying to get to that next level where we're getting the artists. I want to be getting the same artists coming in that like Rosenberg talks to or whoever, you know what I mean? But it's like, those people that are, they're getting hip to the game of like, oh, well, video content is very valuable. You know, so it's like I do have to get people that are even earlier than like the labels and stuff like that. So,
sure.
Anyways, blah blah blah. Tell me about your OCD. When did you find out you were?
I was probably about 9 or 10.
Yeah.
I was having trouble sleeping, and my mom would have to. I don't know. Who cares? I'm not trying to impress anyone. My mom would have to stay in the room for me to fall asleep. And it just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It wasn't something I had before. And so she put me to a therapist and I assume a terrible therapist. I don't remember a lot about it, but enough to when she asked me why I couldn't sleep, I said, well, I can't stop thinking of thoughts. And she's like, what kind of thoughts? And I explained it. It was mostly my grandparents' graves that they weren't dead. I would just imagine the tombstones and things like that over and over again. And then we started talking about other things. So ritualistically, things that I was doing, whether it's lights or my sleeves, I had a problem with sleeves. So if I had long sleeves on, they would have had to be the exact same length. Really fucking ritual stuff.
Yeah.
And she never diagnosed me, which is just annoying because I easily could have gotten a little more of a handle on this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not something my mom doesn't remember talking about. It's, you know, we all remember this fucking story.
Yeah.
So it got worse and worse over time. you know, if I didn't touch this, if I, my foot didn't touch this crack, my grandparents were going to die was a big one.
Yeah.
And so, little things would happen and, I outgrew, which happens a lot. You, over age, you can outgrow the rituals.
Yeah. So you were, so you did have like multiple rituals, like, yeah. like touching door handles and stuff like that. Or like
yeah, it was light. I mean, yeah. it wasn't light. It was,
counting
visually it was light. Yes, yeah. yes. Visually it was light. You didn't see me do it a lot. Sometimes it would happen. My mother has it too.
Right.
She has locks and stuff. So, I think she, it probably resonated with her. I know her mother had it as well. It's a definite hereditary thing.
No shit.
And so she, I think we all just didn't want to say what it was. And I grew out of rituals. So yeah. it was even better.
Yeah.
The problem is I didn't grow out of the thoughts. So my entire life I've dealt with obsessive thoughts disorder, which is a real thing.
Yeah.
And the same way that someone has to touch lights five times, I have to think a lot. And I've gotten a lot better, but it's a treatment and it goes up and down and it's what made me very successful. It's what made me want to start a gallery a week after leaving Interscope.
Right.
It's the thing that makes me drive and be successful, but it's also the thing that tortures me.
Yeah. The OCD and the obsessive thinking, it probably doesn't allow you to ever sit still or be like bored. You can't allow yourself to be bored probably.
No, I mean, I have seven jobs.
Yeah.
You know, I have the gallery. I'm a working comedy writer.
Yeah.
I'm on three shows, you know, four shows total next season. I manage Nova Rockefeller.
Yeah.
I have a lot of shit going on.
Well, and that was another thing that like, listen, I didn't know about your obsessive thinking. What is it called? Obsessive thoughts disorder?
Obsessive thoughts disorder.
Yeah. So
OCD.
I listened to that episode and it was very, touching and heartfelt.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Very good.
Well, I never talk about it much. So.
Yeah. And so that was the thing, I had never even heard of it. And I was like, oh, this makes me think of me. And then you're saying, oh, I have seven jobs. And I, like, people ask me what I do. I'm like, well, I have a fucking about six or seven things that I do to make money off of. And like, it's kind of, that's another thing that just like is hauntingly relatable to you is just, the craziness leading to work ethic. You know
what
I mean?
Well, I had hid that for a very long time. Right? Mm-hmm. I've been dating people, they would see it. And then I just wouldn't tell them, oh, by the way, I'm haunted. You know, I wouldn't tell people that. And then it became so heavy. Good friends, Matt, who I do the podcast with, would know. And obviously some people who are very close to me would be like, I think something's wrong with him at times. And it's easy to call it depression. It's easy to call it other things, which it's just not. It's just that I become depressed by being fucking tortured.
Yeah.
So the podcast, one day I just started talking about it. And it was just sort of like, yeah, I have this thing and I've been diagnosed and I don't really know what to do. And I've been on medication before. I haven't been on meds in a long time. And I decided to say it on the show so that I became accountable in my own life to, you know, people will know I have it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started regimens like running, you know, I run 5 to 6 miles a day. I don't miss a day. And things like that, that sort of work to my advantage, but I'll always have a bad week. And I think probably you listened to the week that I admitted I was breaking down. And, that is extremely vulnerable for me.
Yeah.
That's not something I do normally. So, a listener not knowing I was going through a week of torture sent me a YouTube video and it was just a great YouTube video by this guy named Alan Waits.
Yeah.
Alan Watts.
That was an amazing,
beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's this small, seminar he did. They took about 2 minutes out of it.
Yeah.
You can listen to it. I think just by typing in his name, Alan Watts, and, talks about obsessive thoughts. And, I maybe listened to it 100 times that week. And I played it on the show and it connected with a lot of people. And
yeah,
I broke
the whole
down.
Thing is like, not to be a Mr. Me Too, but like that fucking quote was like, oh my God, like get out of my head. Like
it was
crazy.
The worst. And the joke was, Maddie knew it, you know, when you're, Maddie knows because he's been around me so much.
Yeah.
He knew my immediate thing was, can I get in touch with this person?
Yeah.
He's dead, which was a bummer to me. But it was one of the first times that I heard someone say my disorder.
Yeah.
And so it was a big deal and that was why I brought it up and it definitely controlled that show, which is fine. But I have not been handed, by the way, just so you don't white people problem.
Yeah.
I have not been handed an easy deck as well, which we talk about on the show a lot. My father's tragic death. And, on top of that, I have brain tumors, right. And stuff like that. So I have not been handed an easy life. So, those things have not helped the obsessive thoughts,
right.
But I'm in a much better place. I have to admit I've been very successful, which we've talked about. So there are things that, that do help me, but, it is also a condition. It's something I choose to have.
Yeah. And I'm fearful that people that are coming over from your podcast to listen to this, they'll already know all this shit, but people that listen to mine, I feel like there a lot of people will start listening to your podcast as well.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting then. But yeah, tell me like, what's it like when you find out you have brain tumors?
I mean, it was a bummer.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it was a bummer. The story is that I had a ringing in my ear.
Yeah.
And I didn't go away for 24 hours.
How long ago was this?
6 years.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
A little longer, 6 years. Yeah, my dad. Yeah. Oh, no, my dad died five, so maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So
before or after your dad died?
Crazily weeks after.
Wow. So yeah. It's like
you're... Well, it was stress. We figured the ringing was stress.
Yeah.
So I went in and the doctor was like, oh, this is nothing. Mm-hmm. He's like, this is a ringing ear. I'm going to give you a shot of cortisone. Mm-hmm. It's a steroid. It's inflammation. Mm-hmm. Don't worry.
But as they thought you had an ear infection. Well,
he was right. Yeah. It wasn't anything.
Yeah.
He was like, I'll just give you a shot. It goes away. I go, great. He goes, here's the thing though. Insurance gives you a deal on a brain scan. Because you have this.
Yeah.
He's like, and you should get a brain scan.
Yeah.
So if anyone is listening and gets anything out of this story is that you should get a brain scan.
Yeah.
Because it's like dentistry.
Yeah.
The earlier back you know, if something were to happen, they can compare it.
Right.
No one has that.
Right.
Especially with this world of cell phones and bullshit air conditions.
Absolutely.
So, air condition, not air conditioners. Yeah. I don't want to scare people that they can get brain tumors from air conditioners.
Yeah, turn your AC off.
So, I take this fucking MRI CAT scan.
Yeah.
And 5 days later, I get a call and they were like, hey, you got to come in. I said, I don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, you got to come in though. And mm-hmm. I go, well, it's fine. Just put them on the phone. And then she said, you're not catching my tone.
Mm.
And I just remember my body just
going, oh, fuck.
I knew what she meant. Yeah. And so I assumed I'm dying. And so he clears the office. It's 5:30. Clears the office.
So you go in that day.
Oh, yeah. So a grown man can cry.
Yeah.
And he says, there are three spots in your brain. And I don't know how to tell you this calmly.
Yeah.
He said, so I'm just going to tell you. It could be a lot of things. The two leading things are that you have brain tumors or you have MS. And he's like, and I don't really know how to sugarcoat it.
Yeah.
So I went into a brain spot. I mean, I was in doctors for the next week.
Yeah.
And started getting the tests, and they had just sort of said they were lesions, which is a term they use before they know what it is.
Yeah.
And then about 2 years later, they officially diagnosed it after tests and tests and tests as brain tumors. So they're not growing.
When you say tests and tests and tests, like what do they have to do?
Well, I had a spinal tap.
Oh, wow.
I had a lot of brain scans. Uh-huh. Basically, it's to check growth.
Yeah.
So I've had no growth or very minimal growth over the past 3 years.
Yeah.
And so at this point, if it was in an operable place, it's not. It's right in the middle of my brain in a place called the midbrain where they cannot remove it.
Yeah.
If they do, I become a vegetable or I receive brain damage.
Uh-huh.
So it has to sit.
Uh-huh.
So they will just scan it. And if it grows or multiplies, I'll have chemo or radiation.
Yeah.
So there's been knock on microphone. There's been no growth.
Yeah. And you were saying like that's something where if that wouldn't have happened, you would have never known. And like there could be a lot of people out there sitting with fucking tumors
sadly,
in their head.
Sadly, yes. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, you wouldn't know. And mm-hmm. it's just another example of technology being in front of the disease or the mm-hmm. condition. It's just it's sort of a you could have brain tumors run the spectrum. I learned that fast. One will kill you to next week.
Right.
You know, you can grow and you'll hear that story a lot of times.
Yeah.
And then the other side is that you have them.
You just have them.
And they just stay with you.
And they're just something to make you worry and nothing more than that.
And that's what I have. And the ironic part about that is that I have obsessive thoughts disorder.
Yeah.
So to get brain tumors as someone who thinks about stuff a lot,
mm-hmm.
and then it doesn't hold any more weight than, you know, why hasn't this check come in from Paramount? You know, like those have the same weight for me, which shows it's a condition, not a reality.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just another thing to throw into the pot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With you going through that right after your dad passed, like what was your mental state like when your dad passed? Does the obsessive thought disorder like increase during times of stress like that?
During his sickness, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a really complex few months. Actually a few years. And so
were you guys close?
We were very close. Yeah.
And did you stay close with your mom as well?
Yeah. 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 And I was his keeper.
Okay.
So even before the cancer, I was his keeper. So, that stuff was obsessive. When he became sick, it was obsessive. When he died, it was obsessive. And then there was a relief of he's into a better place.
Or
maybe, I don't know, whatever place you believe in,
but the
thoughts have no real weight. So it doesn't hurt more than sadly, it doesn't hurt more than, you know, a stain on my shirt. I know that sounds fucking terrible,
but
that's what the disorder is. And I'm willing to admit that, you know, like I have also a healthy relationship with emotion. So if my dad dies, I can feel that.
Yeah.
But then there's an unhealthy disorder of compulsive thoughts. So that they almost are not connected. Sort of like rap and writing. It's like there's one thing and then there's another thing. And, and I can distinguish what they are, but that doesn't make it easier.
That's so interesting for me too, because even within my own raps, I have like my separations of like, oh, this is album stuff and this is like fun stuff.
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, when I first fell into your stuff, I think I realized that.
Yeah.
I think that there was something to me in your music, and we brought it up on the show, and I think I sort of brought it up on the show, is that I thought that you lyrically had a bit of obsessive thoughts.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And I could tell that through the music.
Yeah.
And I think I said it, so I'm not lying, but I sensed that there was an obsession in the wording.
Well, yeah, and you worded it as like, oh, I like that you're kind of on your own schedule and you don't release music. And I'm like, that's not really, what it is. That's not the purpose.
And I knew that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just that like I can't put out stuff unless I think it's fucking perfect.
Right.
And I, you know, it's funny. Like I was at Lowen the other night talking to the Milo, this dude Milo. You might like him. He's like very philosophical rapper. He was one of our. He's like the fifth guest on this show.
Okay.
And anyhow, he was like, oh, you know, like. He was just asking me like basically why I don't put shit out. And I'm like, you know, I probably only write like maybe 4 songs a year because like it might.
But do you try more?
Not really. I mean, it's only when it strikes me that I need to write. I don't need to write. I don't have a compulsion to write like some people do. Like some people are writing always.
Like Wayne or whoever.
Yeah. I mean, even like, I don't know, my friend Mike Eagle that I bring up a lot on.
Yeah. Oh, you had him on the show. Yeah. He's been on the show.
He writes so much. And when I talk to him, I'm just like, ugh. I wish that I could write like you write because he writes with an amazing amount of consistency too and releases tons of things per year. And my shit is like sometimes it takes me a week to get 4 bars perfectly placed together. Like that's just how it is. I compare it to like filling out a crossword puzzle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like everything needs to be perfectly placed.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's definitely like a weird obsessive compulsion thing. And I do have some tendencies towards that. I never got into rituals and stuff like that or counting and touching things, but there are weird shits that I have, but blah, blah, blah.
No, I mean, I that's what I sensed from the music, so it makes sense.
It's interesting that you were able
but
to
But I'm
that
surprised
up.
That you don't. I would have also sensed that you wrote more and threw it out, but you don't
do that. I throw a ton of stuff out, but I also know, like, instantly when it's not working. So I'm like, oh, okay, this beat makes me write this.
Yeah.
And it's like, I can tell after 4 or 8 bars, like, this is going nowhere.
Yeah.
And those bars might either go somewhere else or they just get lost in the pile. So.
Well, listening back to Hawk Carl stuff, it's weird because a lot of stuff bothers me. But one that bothers me the most is that just how not serious I was. It's just how I obsessively would not face reality in the music. And that's what I obviously like so much about yours is I couldn't find myself being real. And the one song I'm real on is a song I did with Ninth Wonder, which has lived the longest out of any of my any of my songs, which a song called I've Heard.
That's what I feel like that's always surprises people so much.
It fucking pisses me off.
When you are yourself, like that's the one that's going to go.
And I wish I would have done that more.
Yeah.
And especially because it's one of the only songs I can still listen to without cringing. And Ninth, the beat's great. And I talk about my fears. And in there at 19 years old, you were 20 years old, you hear me say I can't. It does say the thoughts thing. And I was not diagnosed.
Right.
I did not know what it was. I just knew that I had the same thoughts over and over again.
Yeah.
It's weird that that's the one that I allowed myself to do it. And I wish I would have done that more.
It reminds me of Copyright. He was like very much a battle rapper, like punchline, punchline, everything.
His father,
aggressive.
Song about the father.
The song about his dad that he did with RJD2.
It's a great song.
And it's amazing. It's such a good song. And he was like, oh, I remember like reading shit about, like, I was surprised that song went because like, I thought it was just like some emo shit that nobody would want to listen to.
Yeah, great.
And the same thing with Imagining. I was so surprised that like a song, I was scared to put it out. I'm like, oh, this is a song that's like wham wham boohoo for me is how I felt about it. But it like that when you are real with people, people connect to that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what it is.
And this song I've Heard, which I'm sure you can get on iTunes, it talks about the things that I've heard. And it even gets really inside baseball. I say, I've heard the Timbaland talk shit behind my back, which I had heard when they were setting me up, you know, to do this song with him. I heard someone said that he's just doing it for a check. And that's not even real. He doesn't get a check from Interscope. They have him on a retainer for $1 billion back at the time. But like, you know, it was just so much I heard. And then, you know, I was ready to quit. And then I heard Just Blaze and Kanye both said really nice things about me, you know, and I talk about that in the song and there's just, it's all paranoia. It's all nerves. It's all anxiety. And so,
which is what was going on at the time.
Paranoia. So I wish that I had done that more, but, it's something that if I had another attempt at that age, I would have done more.
Right.
And copies, I think it's called like June 7th.
Yeah. June 7th.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The song is great.
That song's amazing.
He also has went more that direction for the record.
Has he? I haven't really kept in contact with
him. We talked recently because I said he was one of my favorite white rappers in the podcast. So he reached out. He's going to jail.
Yeah. I saw a video where he's like going to jail and releasing a mixtape.
For like
or
a year. Yeah.
That sucks.
It sucks. But, I think he like, assaulted a cop.
Ugh.
And so he, you know, he's definitely a different vibe. He's got a little more punk look.
His voice changed since then too. Yeah. I mean, people's voices
every time. Yeah. Thank God mine did.
Yeah, mine changed a lot.
Squawking.
I got my tonsils taken out at age 25. So if you listen to my record that I put out in 07,
like I sound like a fat kid
the whole time.
Yeah, I listen back and I cringe at some of the high pitch.
Oh God.
Mike Shinoda, who I'm very close with growing up and now from Linkin Park, he is so funny about it, where he talks about, because he thinks I should have blown up, and now looks at what's going on and is like, this is so stupid. Right. This should have been you.
Right.
And so he is the first person to be like, had I A&R'd your record, the first thing we would have done is talk about The Voice. And he's right. It would have helped everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, when you're peaking like that, it's not, I mean, it's.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing about getting signed so early is like, it takes a lot of people a lot of time to find not only their symbolic voice, but like their literal voice. Like,
just even as a human.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you learn, I mean, maybe because you're thrown into something young, I now realize that a lot. It's just like, I didn't know my voice until recently.
Yeah.
And I'm 34.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I really only figured out who I really was at its core around time my dad's death, 29, 30. I mean, brain tumors will help you, but you know, you just sort of start to wonder what is this all about? And, you know, now I guess it's not really announced yet, but I received a book deal.
Yeah.
So I'll be writing about Hawk Carl and the experience of being, you know, 19 and all that stuff. And now I'm going back and really thinking about that stuff and writing about it. And it's fucking insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. And I used to hide from it. And, you know, talking about this stuff has been therapeutic. I was on Howard Stern.
Yeah.
Howard Stern had me on to talk about this weird roll call and the 19-year-old rap deal and stuff. And that's when I sort of was just like, why am I being quiet? Like, I could be open about this.
Yeah. When was that? Well, the Howard Stern thing.
That was,
sure. A huge Howard fan, right?
Huge fan. Yeah. It was about 3 years ago. Oh, he started talking about the roll call organically on the show. Cause it was like a regional hit in New York and LA. Uh-huh. And he just thought it was so dumb. And then, you know, they called me and were like, oh, we heard you're the champion. They didn't offer me anything on the show.
Mm-hmm.
They offered me like an ancillary news thing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't call back. And then eventually they called me and they were like, we want you to do the roll call with Howard.
That's amazing.
And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And so I did it and talked about Hawk Carl and, you know, someone made a documentary about me without, I mean, I was in it, but without, I had nothing to do with
like
it.
Like a YouTube documentary thing?
Back then it was a guy named George Meeker who, it was a larger movie and there was like 7 15-minute segments or something like that. Uh-huh. And I was the first 15-minute segment.
Just about the roll call stuff?
Well, it's called Dropped, which I technically wasn't.
Yeah, yeah.
I left the label, but it was about 7 stories about bands who had weird experiences with labels.
Yeah.
Mine had Mac 10 in it, who I was really close with, and mine had Will.i.am in it. So
it's so funny to hear that you're close with Mac 10, I'm saying.
I mean, not as much now.
Yeah, but still, like the fact that at some point in your life, like,
very
close. Mac 10, my homie.
Phone
like,
friends.
Crazy.
We, you know, he's the first person about 14 days into the roll call.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had a mailbox, like a P.O. box in the valley. That's where I grew up. And the woman was Mac 10's mom.
Get out.
Yeah, my mom had told me years ago or a year ago, and I was like, oh, funny. I'm big West Side Connection fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And she,
I love that they tried to make guppies a slang term.
I mean, so many things.
Love it.
So many things in that weird era.
I still say, Dub C used to go, West Sea of Aaliyah.
Oh, yeah. Those are all great.
I still say that.
They were just trying to create memes as a group.
Yeah.
And so she goes, Mac 10, you know, and I get on the radio and I'm starting to become like a bit of a thing. And my mom, I think jokingly tells Mac 10's mom, oh, my son's on the radio now rapping. And she's like, what are you talking about? And so she goes, tell your son to listen.
Yeah.
And so that night, when I would win, they would let me freestyle for about 40 bars once I started to blow up.
Oh, wow.
And so that night I killed. Yeah. And I knew if he listened, there was a part in the back of my head, I was like, if my mom was right.
Yeah.
And that night I got a call on my cell phone.
That's amazing.
And it was just like, where are you?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm at my parents' house in Calabasas. He said, stay there. And I gave him the address.
And then it was a drive-by shooting?
Yeah. And he killed my parents. I'm Batman. He walked out of a Bentley or something.
Yeah.
And walked in my house with a briefcase and sat me down and said,
let's do heroin.
Yeah. No, we did heroin. Yeah. this story gets weird every time. And he opened the briefcase, had $50,000 in it.
For what?
To sign a deal.
Oh, really? So he was trying to sign you too?
Immediately. Yeah.
Yeah.
He had a deal at Capital.
So how did you avoid that $50,000 sitting in front of you?
Dude, because it's so behind the music.
Yeah.
It was like such a Suge Knight, you know, Jerry Heller story.
Yeah,
and I had studied hip hop so long. I was like, this is a terrible idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though I was, you know, in college, you know, basically stringing pennies together,
right.
I knew not to take the deal. Mac later in the documentary says it was smart of Jensen not to take the deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, we stayed friends. He was a very... I would call him with advice. Like, you know, in the industry, a lot of people don't know this. I don't know if it happens in 2014, but back in 99 and 2001, when you get a record deal, some people come out of the woodworks to act a little shitty.
Yeah.
Mostly strong army shit.
Uh-huh.
And that was something I was warned about. Yeah. And Interscope had some people on staff in case you had some worries, which is so ridiculous.
Wow. Like some, just a bully brigade or something.
A real bully brigade. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And, they were on staff for remixes. I did air quotes remixes.
Yeah.
And so I did not, I was like, I thought about asking Interscope to call these people to, through these avenues, but instead I just called Mac once and was just like, hey man, there's these two groups. He had warned me too. I said, there's these two groups of people who are sort of coming after me for money.
You're like, dude, fucking Gerardo keeps trying to ask me for money.
And Bubba. Yeah. No, I was just sort of like, yeah, is there something I should do? And Mac was like, yeah, tell him to call Mac 10.
Yeah.
That's really what he said. Wow. And so both times I said, Mac 10 is in charge of this. So you can call Mac 10. And no one called Mac 10.
Wow. That's crazy.
I mean, he's a gang member.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
He was very kind. And I only celebrate him now.
Knowing that you're kind of an armchair A&R like me and watch the industry closely and have a true passion for for all that stuff. Like when you see the artists that are getting scooped up after one insane viral hit, like your Krayshawns, like your Schmurders, like your Trinidad James, who, like, to a certain extent, Mr. Motherfucking Esquire.
I know, that's a bummer, though.
Yeah, because he's very talented. Yeah. I'm actually trying to get him on the show, so
hopefully. Yeah, but he signed, Universal.
Yeah,
exactly. What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, even to an extent, I thought that it was going to happen to Action Bronson when he got swooped up by Warner and all that. Like, I thought that he would just get swept under the rug, but they've been doing a great job keeping him, like, you know, borderline independent, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, point being is when you see these people kind of get hypnotized by the money and pulled in, like,
but is it though?
I don't know.
I don't think it is. Esquire might be a little different, but the problem is that Esquire may have just left his lane.
Yeah.
My thing is that Action's a good example of someone who is a meme. He's physically a meme.
Yeah.
His gimmick is a meme. He's a chef. That shit is all gimmick.
Oh yeah, it's perfect.
The difference is he's a fucking monster.
Yeah.
He can rap his ass off. He's funny. He's funnier than most stand-ups I work with. He's funnier than me stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, he's so talented that at the end of the day, that rises above, what is it called? Fuck, That's Delicious.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a show that could be his gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it's just another avenue for this very talented MC.
Right, right.
I'm not yet there to say that I think that the system is ruining those people.
Yeah.
I'm there to say that the system might be putting them in a place in which they can't grow.
Yeah.
That might be a little different.
Well,
but was Krayshawn always going to get out of Gucci Gucci? Maybe not.
The reason that I asked, though, is it seems like with your music career, it predated social networking.
100%.
It predated, you know, the time where of virality.
Yeah.
Like, being on the radio 40 days in a row, that was viral then.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Very much so.
Got swooped up as what is the equivalent of a viral artist.
Yeah, I was also one of the 100 or maybe 50 rappers to get signed off Napster, really, because no one knew any of my music.
Right.
Yeah.
So what advice would you give to those people at this day, like knowing how your experience with the majors went?
I'm working with Nova Rockefeller, who you've had on the show. She's at Island, so she's in a major. So I've watched it. I've watched the differences.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say in 2000 and 2000, 2001,
mm-hmm.
is that we were hoping the label would take control.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. A lot of people had very long careers because the label put them in the machine.
Mm-hmm.
In 2014, it seems the machine is just going to radio.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is really insignificant.
Right.
When you get that $1 million push to go to radio, that's all that means anything in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's the only thing the labels still have power over.
Seems all it is.
Yeah.
It's all it would be. But Nova, who's this beautiful girl who could easily go viral in a million ways,
mm-hmm.
there is a point where we do need that money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think someone who gets signed to a label, there is a point where you go, well, how talented am I?
Mm-hmm.
And that's different than 2014. I mean, then in 2000, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In 2000, you could get away with a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
In 2014, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited about the music that we're making with Nova. And I think that at the end of the day, that's going to speak for itself. We could have put her in a G-string in the video. We could have done a lot of things to make 2 million views.
And
we could have done something that I wouldn't have been happy with.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't. And, you know, whenever she's put her butt or whatever on Instagram, that's her decision.
Mm-hmm.
She'll check with me and I go, you do you. You're in your mid-20s.
Note to self, I need to follow her on Instagram apparently.
she's down to do it every once in a while. And so I'm like, you know, it's her decision. But when you bring up those other... Does Trinidad James have more than that?
Yeah.
The answer is probably no.
Yeah.
Well, and that's not a diss to him.
Yeah.
It's just that I think maybe labels know two things. One, to put out a quick fire. mm-hmm. quick fire out. And then maybe another one, which is, well, we invested in Iggy Azalea. Mm-hmm. And they did an incredible job with Iggy.
In the modern era, I haven't fleshed this thought out, but I think about it a lot. It's like you got your artist like Iggy Azalea, where she was doing well on the internet, but not, had not yet gone extremely viral. Like she hadn't written her one hit yet.
By the way, talking about voice, I don't know. Well, I mean, that's ironic. Obviously. It's ironic, but I don't think she had found her voice.
Yeah.
I think she found her voice. Unfortunately, it's fictitious.
If you watch the Pussy video when it came out, you went, oh, this is a girl who understands aesthetic and who understands her brand.
Yeah.
And that could be something. And they were smart to scoop her up because they knew that a Crazy would come out. And that Pussy was not her big hit.
No.
Someone like Trinidad James, like, it's clear that, like, most people wait their entire career to have that song.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And the fact that they weren't that they hadn't already scooped him up so that they could that they could put out that song.
Yeah.
But invested in him on the bet that he would make another one of those?
No.
That's a silly investment.
And I've been I was very vocal on the podcast about how I thought Chief Keef was going to be a humongous failure. And I was very vocal about it. And not only so vocal that when Nova, we had a real record label fury at one moment and we were going to meet everyone and we went in with Lior Cohen and Lior made me feel stupid for comparing Nova above Chief Keef. And he sort of like kind of mimicked me a little bit. And I said, well, in 6 months when he doesn't have a career, we'll see what goes on. And it was sort of a real shitty thing to say to Lior, but not that he signed him, so it wasn't like I was dissing his sign, but he really made me feel like Chief was going to be this humongous thing. And I was like, he's not. He's not a rapper. Schmurder's got a better chance because he can rap. You know, he can actually sort of spit.
Schmurder, I like it. And I fuck with that song heavy.
It's a great song.
The reason I love that song is like, I always hated that whole thing of like, oh, it goes in the club. But if you're at a fucking club or a party or whatever, and that song comes on, like the whole environment changes. Yeah. It's amazing.
But he can kind of rap.
He can kind of rap. But at the same time, traditionally, that's not a radio hit. And therefore, they're going to try and make him make radio hits, and that's going to go way against his grain.
At the end of the day, you know Macklemore is going to have another hit. It's not going to be Thrift Shop, but he is going to have another hit because at the end of the day, he can rap. That's it.
Well, yeah,
that's it.
And he's aligned himself to make himself a viable pop artist.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
And he can, at the end of the day, it just has to do with if you can rap. Yeah. And that's why Nova was such a no-brainer for me to start working with, is because I was like, oh, she's a man. She's an animal.
Yeah.
Even if we have to put her in pop to break, at the end of the day, we could put her on another show and she's going to spit her ass off.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you say why those people, I think we might also be giving people talents they might not have.
Mm-hmm.
We have to, I think that in music, especially hip hop, it might be you know, there's only going to be a few Will Smiths where someone comes out and is sort of jokey and parents just don't understand, becomes one of the biggest movie stars of all time.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare in 2014.
I think Drake's going to be our next Will Smith.
By the way, I don't think even like a stretch. I think that's a
much better rapper.
And by the way, you know who else is going to be a huge actor? Nicki Minaj.
You think?
I know so.
No shit.
Yeah. I mean, she's made some bad decisions showing up in some movies here and there.
Yeah.
But I mean, Drake's a given.
Yeah, that's Drake's an amazing actor.
Amazing actor. I mean, he's an actor.
He killed it on Saturday Night Live.
I've heard I never saw Anchorman 2, but I heard that he steals that scene.
Oh, I didn't even know he was in it.
Yeah, he's in it.
That's amazing. I might have to go watch it just because of that.
He has a cameo. But I think, you know, those kind of people are very rare. And also, I was on Nicki during the Smack DVD stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when she was on the Cypher, I was like, I think I tweeted.
I saw the Cypher, I went, oh my God, it's like, this is game fucking over.
I think I tweeted, we just found the new Raucous rapper.
Dude,
she was a Raucous rapper. Yeah, she sounded like she was on Raucous.
Oh, it was so barred out and so, it was so lyrical.
Ugh.
And I remember tweeting like, oh my God, I'm obsessed with this right now. And I literally had watched her verse on the Cypher like fucking 20 times in a row. To the point where I had it memorized.
Piggy Bank or whatever that song she had released right before that too. Iggy Piggy or whatever. I mean, she was on a real roll of just like an underground rapper, and then to watch where she's went, it's fine with me because at the end of the day, like I said, she can rap.
Yeah, absolutely. And
Oscar by that trash can.
Yeah,
she's a beast.
And that's what I'm saying. There is this certain different level of talent that those kind of people have, and fucking range. They just have a crazy range. Like she can do so many different things.
And Nicki could have easily been, you know, the Monster verse she'll never beat the Monster verse, in my opinion. She'll never have a better verse than Monster. And that is a huge breaking point for her when she outshined the biggest rappers in the world.
Exactly.
And so I think that kind of shit, you have to make your own opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
And I think with Nova, we'll be able to do that. And I think with Hot Carl, it was just a different industry.
Right.
But had I been able to do what I wanted to do, I think it would have been good.
Well, I think in the current industry right now, and we're getting way off topic, but that's okay. The current industry right now, it's like you have to be so multifaceted because a pop star right now can sing, a pop star right now can rap, a pop star right now can write songs.
Yeah.
Drake can do what is the best fucking R&B song, R&B pop song, like the return of the Mac of the year, like with Just Hold On, We're Going Home, all the way to like just crazy bars like 0 to 100.
Yeah.
Nicki Minaj can do the same thing. And that's the thing. There's only five or six rappers that are really like out there like that.
Yeah. Know? I mean, and I think the key to success to me, and I think it's very strange, and I probably am one of the only people to have this opinion, is you have to find that medium between what we liked about Thurston Howell III and cannabis and people who didn't become famous, Chino XL, people who we liked because of a certain thing. Mm-hmm. And then you just have to make it viable. Mm-hmm. And Nicki is that, you know, right. Drake is that. They're both, right. they both know, you know, they know who, and I don't know about Nicki, but I know Drake knows who Punch and Words is.
Oh dude. So he's like a backpacker for sure. Dude.
Yeah. So I think it's, some people understood it. You know, Shinoda is always a good example that I use because we're close. But yeah. I'm a fan of what Linkin Park did. I like the hits because they're hits and I know them. You know, for him to bring Rakim in on the new single, which is what he did. Rakim's on the new Linkin Park single.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
And then, you know, when we joke around and text each other about, you know, where's Master Fool? You know, that'll come from him. So like, you know, I think that some people just have been better at taking those influences and using them correctly.
I really thought Punch would be a thing, like from the Lyricist Lounge show. He was tight.
Yeah, Abnormal. I don't know if you know Ab. Do you know Ab?
No.
I grew up with Abnormal, real name Ali Alimi. Uh-huh. We were Calabasas kids, and in seventh grade, he wore the Lynch Mob shirt to school.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, there's another one.
Wow.
And he's Persian.
Speaking of which, the Calabasas kids would have been a great rap name, I think.
It would have been. Probably what I should have went under. And so he was wearing a Lynch Mob shirt, and I went up to him and was like, oh, there's another one. We became really close, and he ended up on the Hot Carl album, and he's releasing an 818 album on August 18th that I have a verse on, and I think like J-Ro's on it, and Swag. Styles of Beyond, and all these people. And so, you know, we sort of grew up. He was on Lyricist Lounge. Mm-hmm. He was on the TV show.
Oh, okay.
He was like the airplane sketch. He's rapping on all these things. He's just one of the members. I think Def Jeff brought him in. Uh-huh. And he then became Hip Hop Harry. Do you know what that is?
No.
It's like Barney, but it's a bear.
Wow.
And he's the voice.
Yeah.
And he rapped, you know, he was like, he was Barney for rap.
Yeah.
And so we came up together, and now he's still sort of rhyming and doing other things. But he's an example of someone from Lyricist Lounge. I remember when he broke, he came over, I think it was at a dorm. I was at USC, and he came over, and we were just like, holy shit, you're on a show with Master Fool and Punchin' Words. Yeah. And we thought it was so crazy.
That's tight.
But yeah, it's a different era.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like we did what we came to accomplish.
We always do.
We found out a lot of stuff about you, and then we got to bullshit about the record industry, which is what I love to do.
All I want
to
do.
Yeah. So let's tell the people where they can find you, what they should be looking for, all that stuff.
Yeah. It's at JensenClan88. It's with a C. I mostly just tweet out jokes all the time and a lot of hip hop stuff.
Yeah.
And I have a weekly podcast called Get Up On This. And it's me and my friend Matt Robinson. And each week we get you up on stuff early.
There are three ways to listen to it.
You can my dumb, stupid, repetitive thing. Yeah. But you can just go to iTunes and type in Get Up On This. And every one of our episodes are up there. And sometimes we'll deviate from the system. We do another show called Baby Talk. I have live. I do a lot of comedy.
Yeah.
So,
do you do stand up?
I do, but I don't promote them.
Did you pursue it for a while?
For reals. Yeah. After in college, before Hot Carl, I was doing open mics, and then at the end of Hot Carl, I was doing open mics, and then I just never really felt.
It's not like your lane or whatever.
No, yeah. I felt the same when I bombed as when I did phenomenal.
Yeah.
It was just like, oh, well, next one will bomb,
right.
And you shouldn't be that guy,
right?
And so I write for a lot of people, and I'm on a bunch of shows. Hopefully this Kevin Smith pilot gets picked up, which would be great for AMC. And then I'm on a couple things that I haven't really been able to talk about yet. But one is a show on CNBC, which I just signed on for a pilot, the host of. So there's a lot of stuff
awesome
in the pipeline.
I really can't suggest it enough for you guys to listen to the Get Up On This podcast.
Yeah, it wasn't super funny today. But I think it's because I think I went out of my way to really sort of talk about this Hawk Carl thing.
Well, for this one?
Yeah. Oh,
I don't expect anybody to ever be funny. I think you did great, and I think people will be very entertained. But I know that the followers that listen to this podcast will heavily enjoy their podcast because there are a lot of similar themes, and I know that the people that listen to this do appreciate being early on things, and that's a great way to find out about new stuff. So thank you so much for coming.
Oh my God, please, thank you.
The other thing, I always love doing podcasts where people were involved in the music industry or are involved in the music industry didn't necessarily fucking stay as musicians. I love the fact that like rappers talk about always like being hustlers, you know, like, oh, we're hustlers, we're out here making paper. And the fact of the matter is you hustled into the music industry. And once you realize it didn't work out,
kept
you
moving.
Fucking kept hustling and you just have a backup plan. And that's what it is.
And that's why I look up to guys that did it also. You know, there's a, one of the guys from Hangar
18.
Yeah. That was
Alaska. No,
the, one of the guys.
There's Alaska. There's Wind Breeze, who I see at the gym always. And then there's NASA, who was there.
No, this was like a DJ.
I don't know.
Anyway, yeah. He made a movie.
Oh, yeah. Adult Rappers.
Adult Rappers, yeah.
Paul something or another.
Yeah, I'm in. I don't know if it ever came out.
Yeah.
But like, it's funny to hear certain people that really decided to get out and actually get out. But then it's weird, you know. It's weird to hear people that are still trying. But then I look up to people like Murs who never gave up.
Yeah.
So it's a real fine line between what, you know, RA is amazing still. I mean, he's still rapping his ass off. But then there's other instances where you're like, oh man, that guy's still rapping.
Yeah, there's some people that I definitely looked up to 10 years ago that I see around now and I'm like, it's sad.
It's too much.
I wish that you would have known when to get out, or like, you know, the reason that I do this is because I'm like, I want to know when to get out and have something to fall back on and still be involved in it.
But you do other stuff.
Yeah, I do a ton of other stuff. So anyways, blah, blah, blah. My name is Lee. You guys might know me as Intuition. Follow me on Twitter at It's Intuition. Follow my man behind the boards, Ben Shim, making the shit sound buttery at I Am Database, based with two S's. Follow us as a unit on at That's Kinda Neat, where I'd never fucking tweet, but that's okay. And subscribe to us on the podcast app. Download it on your iPhone and search for us and subscribe. It'll make your life so much easier. Subscribe to my man, Jensen Karp, on Get Up On This. Search for that while you're searching
for Tyrese, Kinda Neat. Right?
Fuck Tyrese. If you see me in the streets, know that I'm beefing. What else? I think that's it. Fuck it. Whatever. We'll have new video content soon, and soon we'll start premiering stuff on complex.com. Thank you guys for tuning in. That was Jensen. My name's Lee, and this was Kinda Neat.
Bye.
Thanks, man. That was great. I could fucking bullshit about that.